Welcome to our second session with Dr. John Wilson on Dietrich Bonhoeffer in his writings, issues, and conflicts. Today's topic is resistance, the ethics, and the conspiracy. And now John will open with prayer.
Our prayer is by Bonhoeffer. From Christmas 1943, from the Letters and Papers. O God, early in the morning I cry to you, help me to pray and to concentrate my thoughts on you. I cannot do this alone. In me there is darkness, but with you there is light. I am lonely, but you do not leave me. I'm feeble in heart, but with you there is help. I am restless, but with you there is peace. In me there is bitterness, but with you there is patience. I do not understand your ways, but you know the way for me. Heavenly Father, I praise and thank you for the peace of the night. I praise and thank you for this new day. I praise and thank you for all your goodness and faithfulness throughout my life. You have granted me many blessings. Now let me also accept what is hard from your hand. You will lay on me no more than I can bear. You make all things work together for good for your children. In Christ's name, amen. I'd like to begin with maybe a spot of humor. We say Bonhoeffer, that's a good Americanization of the word. Actually, it's Bonhoeffer because it's O-E, and that's umlaut it, so you say Bonhoeffer. Now, of course, we Americanize or make English pronunciations, and there's some funny history to this. There's an old story, apparently quite true, that Oxford and Cambridge would pronounce foreign words differently, if you ever heard this story. And one of them would pronounce the word as it's pronounced in the foreign language, and the other one would pronounce the word according to English phonetics. So, for example, Don Quixote. One of them said Don Quixote, and the other one said Don Quixote. That's probably Oxford that did that one. Oxford was so very stuffy for such a long time. On the books, before I go any further, recommend Life Together, 1938. This is while he is still working, or at the time, working with the confessional seminaries. And he writes this for the seminary community. It's quite a striking book. Some of you remember John Burgess, who's often spoken here. This is, I think, Burgess's favorite little Bonhoeffer book. It's very worthwhile reading, just to read through his concept of a church community, what it would be like. This is the ethics as it's currently published. It's not terribly big, 350 pages or so. And that's what I'm taking material from today, is from the ethics. Now, on the ethics, these were collected notes. The book, what makes up the book, are collected notes after he was arrested. And there were certainly a jumble. No one knew the exact order. And there's a lot of argument about what the right order of these things should be. Just to say that, it's one of the big questions about Bonhoeffer research today is what would he have done after the war had he lived? What would he have changed? What would he not have changed? How would he have put things together? What would he have written? And we really don't know that because we get so much fluctuation here and there. The ethics also, we have blocks of thought that go together more or less. And again, the argument about how they fit together. What I've done today, again, is select texts. I think selection of texts to make a point, to show Bonhoeffer's thought is a very valuable way to do it. Of course, the end result should be for you to get the book so you can read the whole thing and not just my excerpts, because I'm coming out with a very one-sided presentation of Bonhoeffer's things I wanted to pull out to show you that are certainly characteristic of Bonhoeffer, but at the same time, not often talked about. I'm going to pull the, you know, this in some ways this is very unusual. You're going to see this, quite unusual. All right, you have the dates, 1940 to 1943. All right, let's go to the first one, number one. Responsibility and freedom. This is the theme that I've taken to select the texts. And you'll see all of these texts have to do with responsibility and freedom. All right, I'm going to read from my text and you have the text up above. And I will, as occasion arises, I will comment on them. And if you have questions at any time, certainly you're free to comment on them. Right, first, in the course of historical life, there comes a point where the exact observance of the formal law finds itself in violent conflict with the ineluctable necessities. At this point, responsible action leaves behind it in the domain of principle and convention, and is confronted by the extraordinary situation of ultimate necessities, a situation which no law can control. These necessities appeal directly to the free responsibility of the agent, responsibility bound by no law. Now, the first thing to notice right off is the necessity, certainly. And then after that, leaves behind the domain of principle. Now, this has gotten a lot of attention in Bonhoeffer's research because he will say, does say, principles are abstract. Concrete situations and necessities are not abstract. Well, we're going to have a lot to reflect on as we go through these texts. No principles fit. Principles are abstract. Freedom has to do with the situation in which we're in. This is often called situation ethics, as opposed to ethics based on principles. A lot of discussion in philosophy and in theology about the difference between a situation ethics and principles ethics, but this is beyond situation ethics. This is extremely personal and has extremely to do with his personal relationship to God, as we will see. He's going to make some startling claims as we go through this. Number two. Well, of course, the extraordinary necessity here is he's joined, by this time, he's joined the plot. He knows about it and he's into it. So this has to do with, all has to do with the plot to kill Hitler. And not only Hitler, he's quite aware that they're going to have to most probably, not just imprison the top echelon of Nazi leadership, but very probably kill them because there's going to be resistance. And who else is going to be there? And all of this he's quite aware of. The extraordinary necessity appeals to the freedom of those who are responsible. There is no law behind which the responsible person can seek cover. Here one must make one's decision as a free venture, together with the open admission that here the law is being violated and that necessity obeys no commandment. One's own decision and deed are entrusted to the divine government of history. Now you see, he's way out on a plank over the ocean. He's putting himself out there as he deliberates on what it means to make decisions in this situation. For him as a Christian, the very devout Christian, and certainly as a pacifist, one who has been a pacifist and is leaving the path of pacifism. Next one. Jesus is concerned solely with love for the real person. And for that reason, he is able to enter into the fellowship of the guilt of persons and take the burden of guilt upon himself. From his selfless love, from his freedom from sin, Jesus enters into the guilt of humanity and takes this guilt upon himself. All right, that's the cross, right? The cross takes the guilt. Christ takes the guilt upon himself. So this is something Bonhoeffer is thinking of. The guilt that Christ takes on is also his own guilt. And he's saying all through this, innocence isn't here. This doesn't have to do with innocence. Number four, when someone takes guilt upon himself, and here I've skipped some passages, so he's not talking about Jesus here, he's talking about himself. When someone takes guilt upon himself and responsibility, he does it in the knowledge that this freedom is forced upon him and that in it he is dependent on grace. Before other men, the person of free responsibility is justified by necessity. Before God, he hopes only for mercy. So everybody can talk about other people, how justified the murder of Hitler is and the elimination of the top echelon of the government. But before God, only mercy. This is quite something. You think about, again, principle ethics, acting on clear principle, there's no guilt if the principle is in itself an absolute. The elimination of a tyrant. Just call to mind very quickly Calvin on this, the rebellion against a tyrant. Calvin says very clearly, this is not something for the people to do, it's for the lesser magistrates, as he calls them, that is to say, government officials who have authority under whoever the tyrant is, a king or some other kind of official, but not a popular revolt. So officials who would take the responsibility to eliminate the leader, that still falls in the area of principles. Bonhoeffer is radically without principles in this deliberation. Number five, responsibility and freedom are corresponding concepts. The responsible person acts in the freedom of his own self. The proof of this freedom is the fact that nothing can answer for him. Nothing can exonerate him except his own deed. Neither the purity of the motivation, nor the opportune circumstances, nor the value, nor the significant purpose of an intended undertaking can become a law to which he can appeal as an authority and by which he can be acquitted. For in that case, he would no longer be truly free. The action of the responsible person is performed in the obligation which alone gives freedom, the obligation to God and to our neighbor as they confront us in Jesus Christ. 6. Good, as what is responsible, is performed in the surrender to God of the deed, which has become necessary, and which is for that very reason free. For it is God who sees the heart, who weighs up the deed, and directs the course of history. All that's very remarkable. To say all of that, including God directing the course of history, and to find himself in there, within it, as this necessary deed in which there is no cover, no excuse, but the necessity of the deed itself, and taking the necessity out of the hand of God, which is what he's doing. This is a radical, radical thought. You see, it'd be quite easy, and at other times in history, for other people working from principles, not to be involved in such deep personal existential anxiety, thought, faith, wrestling with this problem. And then to say, God directs the course of history, and one is putting oneself into that, asking for God's mercy. Well, the next statement is just one that kind of knocked my socks off, the one that comes up next. The person who acts in the freedom of his own most personal responsibility is precisely the person who sees his action finally committed to the guidance of God. The free deed itself, the free deed knows itself in the end as the deed of God. That's one that took my socks off. You really have to think. The decision knows itself as guidance. God's guidance. The free venture knows itself as divine necessity. Divine necessity. It is in the free abandonment of knowledge of his own good that one performs the good of God. I think it's a remarkable statement. Guidance so sure, so free and responsible, in the end, the deed of God. Anybody want to remark on that, or you want to run out of the room screaming or something? Let's go to 8. Obedience and responsibility are interlinked in such a way that one cannot say that responsibility begins only where obedience leaves off, but rather that obedience is rendered in responsibility. Now he's thinking certainly here of obedience to God. Obedience without freedom is slavery. Freedom without obedience is arbitrary self-will. Obedience binds the creature to the creator, and freedom enables the creature to stand before the creator as one who is made in the creator's image. The next one. Obedience knows what is good and does it. Freedom dares to act and abandons to God the judgment of good and evil. Number 10, there is a freedom from the whole of divine law, a freedom which breaks this law, but only in order to give effect to it anew. The suspension of the law can only serve the true fulfillment of it. In war, for example, now he makes very few references to war. And what comes up immediately when war enters the discussion is just war theory, which in our tradition goes back clearly to Augustine, who gave us the first clear just war theory. And it has to do with tyranny. It has to do with the authority that's authorized to conduct action against tyranny. But Bonhoeffer never refers to just war theory. Very few references in the Ethics to war. And here, it's simply a matter of making the point that you act in order against the law in order to reestablish the law. And he says, for example, war against an evil power in order to reestablish a law. So that he's using that parallel at that point. But I actually included that sentence only to illustrate a point, and that otherwise in the book he never uses just war theory. It's not there. It's purely this personal responsibility, almost agonizing personal responsibility for the act. Number 11, the commandment of God commands freedom, and that which lies beyond the range of what can be commanded freedom is the true object of the commandment. This permission and freedom are never detached from God. It is always God's permission, and it is only as such that it gives freedom from the torment of anxiety in the face of each decision and deed. Or again, elaboration, concept of freedom as he intended it. I'm going to pause here and ask you for comments or questions, or if you want, just to think about it. That certainly also, just to think about these words.
A little different perspective, but if you take the abortion issue today, which some believe is the killing of an infant or someone who is actually alive, aren't there parallels there if people take it to the extreme? The government comes up with rules and laws, but if you really believe it's murder, then you would be entitled to take actions on your own part.
Anyone want to comment on that? Well, this is truly a can of worms, is it not? The abortion question. Just to comment in general, right? I heard a very responsible, free theologian talking about this, and he said he thought that it was something Christians in their conscience would not do, except in the most dire circumstances. But the Christians would also recognize that there are people who are not Christian and who are often in dire circumstances, so that it does not become a law, absolutely, but never avoids the problem of Christian conscience when Christians are confronted with the decision. Anyone else do you want to, Bobby?
Yeah, I think it is interesting to compare this, the abortion question, to Bonhoeffer's, I want to call it a dilemma, but I'm not sure he really had a dilemma. I think he was pretty certain about what he was doing. In his case, it feels to me like his action would have been to defend, to help, to do the greater good. I don't know, I'm not sure that works with the abortion question because it's more finely pointed. But yeah. In any case, it is, you're right, it is a can of worms, so.
Difficult question. But I think what Bobby's asking is, are they, they're not really the same issues. They're two different issues.
But I'm looking at it from the perspective that if someone believes strongly enough, they can ignore whatever the majority of people have put into place legislatively or otherwise. And that gets to be pretty dangerous.
Yes. And I think we do have a dilemma today where the churches were so much divided. Socially and politically. So we have a radical right, and in a lot of ways we have a radical left, and we have a large middle ground. There's quite an area of disagreement, often to the point of violence, about what God wills. And this is truly also a great dilemma for the church. Ted.
So as I hear these things, two questions occur to me. One is, to what extent am I hearing what I want to hear in these things that he's written and sort of troubled over? Just sort of fitting the narrative of his writing to things that I want to wrestle with. And then the other question is, isn't he saying essentially that, yes, you have to trust in God to guide you and trust in the fact that your free choice is actually coming from God's guidance. But he's also saying in parallel, that's a struggle. It's not something where you are absolutely convinced that you have the answer divinely handed to you from God. And, and it's just like, you don't even have to give it a thought.
Yeah, it's remarkable that he's removed all the excuses, all the protections, all the things he might appeal to, law, just war theory, the guy's a tyrant, all these things he's moved aside. So purely this has to do with the relationship to God. And he's breaking the law. Again, this isn't just going to be the murder of Hitler. And who knows what else is going to come. I mean, one of the great problems that conspiracy has is the problem of violence being spread throughout the country. The sense of him being so alone here, right? Now, he's speaking, in writing the book, he's not addressing a church. He's not even really talking to a congregation. He's not talking to a congregation. This is him in the conspiracy situation. He's also moving some of this time. He's in a foreign land. But he is thinking this and writing this very much in his own, well, within himself. He doesn't talk about a conversation partner. There aren't any. His conversation partner is God. Now, I don't think I got your first question.
Well, my first question was just wondering how much this is me parsing what he, as I think about this, am I just parsing what he wrote for the meaning I want, or is this his core thesis about responsibility and freedom?
I think it's core thesis. But again, the question is, what would he have done with all this material? Remember, these are just loose leaf, a collection of different papers put together by editors later. What would he have done after the war, had he lived? And there's a great question. We just do not know, right? We can make guesses. I don't think he was not serious, or he would have come to the after the war and said, well, I reject all of that. But how would he have reflected differently? Maybe he wouldn't have reflected differently at all. Maybe he would have said, that's exactly what I thought then and what I think now. But after the war, restoration of peace, peace would have come again. And a great interest from the Allies, especially the Western Allies, in justice, a just peace. So again, we don't know. Others? Well, with this, I'm going to come to the conspiracy. And again, I have texts. Okay, in 1940, while he was working on ethics, Bonhoeffer was brought into the conspiracy to murder Hitler and replace the Nazi government. And then, by way of information, there were different cells of conspiracy, mainly in the army and indeed in the high command. This is generals. And just let me pause to say, generals definitely involved in this. One I'm going to be talking about at the end, if I can get to it. The Nazi army, millions of men. The number of generals is estimated something like 3,500 generals at different levels. So having generals in the high command, maybe not all that unusual. Nevertheless, they were there and they were plotters. They were part of the conspiracy. Okay, continued. There were different cells in the conspiracy, mainly in the army, linked by secret communication. Records were kept of the atrocities, and this information was given to Bonhoeffer. The cell he joined consisted of higher officials of the Abwehr, the espionage and counter-espionage organization of the army. At the top was Admiral Canaris. All immediate subordinates were also conspirators. Now, this is very high up. Conspiracy leaders at the very top. Now, again, to reflect on who was involved in the conspiracies. Now, certainly there were communist cells. Communist cells at this time are mainly intellectuals. And there were some communist attempts to assassinate Hitler, but they pale actually in comparison with what the army, people in the army were doing. There's also a student group, Munich, the White Rose. There was a group of students who were involved in a conspiracy against the Nazis in Munich. They couldn't do much except target Munich officials, but was exposed. They were betrayed, and young woman and a young man who had been leading the conspiracy were hanged. Bonhoeffer was not only the religious objector, the one who objected to Hitler and joined in conspiracy in one way or another. There was also a Catholic priest. And all of this is, again, in the history books. But certainly Bonhoeffer stands out among all of them for his because of his writings. All right, further, we go to 13. Bonhoeffer had no part in plans or acts to murder Hitler. He rather acted as a messenger between the conspiracy and the Allies, especially the British. He could travel outside Germany as a secret agent of the Abwehr. In 1941 and 1942, he was three times in Switzerland, once in Italy, Norway, and Sweden, all with the purpose of communicating with allies on behalf of the conspiracy, whose plans and list of conspirators he passed on. During trips to Switzerland, he was also active in arranging for a group of Jews to escape Germany. Right, so it's always been a kind of astonishing to me that as much as he was being watched by the police, that he could have been taken into the Abwehr, into this counter-espionage unit, without the police raising big questions. And apparently in the apparatus, and the Nazi government had a very elaborate apparatus, it was possible to stop information from going from one place to another if an official had some reason for stopping it. For example, participation in conspiracy. And we know this happened. Information was stopped, sidetracked, or just stopped altogether, not passed on. And that apparently happened here with Bonhoeffer. So he's officially part of the German espionage, counter-espionage organization. 14, the conspiracy planned to replace the Nazi government with generals and other officials who were a trusted part of the conspiracy. Bonhoeffer communicated to an English bishop the plan of conditional surrender after Hitler and the purging of his supporters in the government. The plan included the Allies' recognition of the new government. The bishop forwarded this to the British Foreign Office, presumably Churchill himself saw it. I guess I'm missing a word or two there. But the plan was rejected, one reason being skepticism that the plan would work. The Allies would accept only unconditional surrender. But there was a lot more here, and let me comment on that. We know things, subsequent research. For one thing, the conspiracy was not including Russia. They were not talking to the Russians. This was purely Western. And Churchill, the British government, who was making the big decisions here about what to do with this information, said Stalin would have reacted poorly or badly to this, right? On the other hand, if this conspiracy was involved in making this arrangement with us, maybe they would make a separate one with Stalin. We don't know what they're doing. They're not saying everything, or are they? And then another one was, we don't want these generals. They're the problem. Well, they've always been part of the problem. Now, we know from personal testimonies of people involved in the conspiracy that some of them really were very deep Christians. Skip over to some information on that, if I can find what I'm looking for. Yes, General Henning von Treskow participated in Stauffenberg's plot to kill Hitler. And we know from, the Germans have done an enormous amount of research on who was doing what during the war. And because this general emerges as a major figure in the conspiracy, a great deal of work has been done on him. But this is what he says before his execution. He participates in the plot that Stauffenberg has, the one to blow up Hitler in his bunker or at the special meeting with him, kills everybody else, but doesn't kill Hitler. Stauffenberg's bomb. And Henning is actually the big organizer for all of this. He has been involved in resisting Hitler from very early on in the war. As soon as Poland is invaded, he is a conspirator against Hitler. But just before his death, before his execution, he says, Hitler is not only the arch enemy of Germany, but also of the world. When in a short while I stand before God's judgment to give account of what I did and did not do, I believe that I can refer with good conscience to what I have done in the struggle against Hitler. God once promised Abraham that he would not destroy Sodom if only 10 righteous people were there. So do I hope that God, for our sakes, will not destroy Germany. That's a strong statement. Again, as I said, research in the last years, well, certainly since the war, all kinds of material has come to light. And this general has his defenders and his critics. And critics say, well, this guy was a major figure and on the battlefield in a lot of situations. And what we hear in defense is he was actively involved in his own mind in defeating communism. And then how much did he do to help prevent the massacre of innocents? And there we get back and forth too, two different sides on it. He didn't do enough. He didn't do this, he didn't do that. And the other side, he couldn't do it. He didn't have the power. He might have known about it, but he didn't have the authority. And at the same time, he was working diligently on the problem of eliminating Hitler and those who supported him. We'll return to the texts. I can find my place. Okay, Bonhoeffer believed the plan of the conspirators was the better alternative to unconditional surrender because, among other reasons, it would demonstrate to the populace the anti-Nazi convictions of the conspirators, who were highly placed officials, government officials and other officials. And provide order and continuity in the transition and prepare the way for a new election. So it was supposed to be a peaceful transition. This was the thought, a peaceful transition over to new elections. And to show that here in the top leadership, there was anti-Nazi, anti-Hitler, and that the people should see this and understand it and embrace it. Well, that was also a guess, because as we know, the lower middle class workers were always, right up to the end, loyal to Hitler. All right, the next one. On April 5th, 1943, Bonhoeffer was arrested and imprisoned on charges of aiding Jews and interference with the obligation to serve in the army, an offense which could carry the death penalty. He remained without trial in prison in Berlin for almost 2 years. Next file. The failed attempt to kill Hitler by Stauffenberg, and Tom Cruise made that movie, Valkyrie, about Stauffenberg. So, of course, it's Hollywood. So, July 20, 1944, led to intense searching by the Gestapo and SS, which exposed the conspiracy. Bonhoeffer was moved to a prison camp, Flossenbürg, where he was charged with treason, tried and hanged April 9, 1945, 2 weeks before the American army liberated the camp. It's also interesting, too, at that execution, there were five who were tried and executed at the same time. One was Canaris, and the other was another high official in the conspiracy. They were executed with Bonhoeffer. It's interesting that we have the information that they were stripped naked for the hanging, and then the bodies were burned. So there's no monument, whatever, remaining from the actual burning of the bodies. Next one. This is a report. I thought this quite interesting. I decided to include it. A report of a meeting in the home of a friend, Wolfried Dieter Zimmermann, December 1942, first published in 1969, which I found in Rasmussen's Dietrich Bonhoeffer, Reality and Resistance. All right, this is a quotation. The discussion of tyrannicide, killing the tyrant, lasted into the early morning hours, especially with Werner von Haeften, who had access to military conferences held by Hitler, and it was possible for him to enter armed with a pistol. This is a relatively young man, this von Haeften. Zimmermann, who's reporting the conversation, was certain about the points Bonhoeffer made over and over again. Von Haeften was speaking from a Christian conscience, outraged at Hitler's crimes, and from a patriotism despondent over Germany's future. In the next file, he asked Bonhoeffer if he should kill Hitler. Bonhoeffer's answer was, as Zimmermann paraphrases it, one, the issue is not between you and Hitler and his death and or yours, nor is it even between you and your conscience and Hitler's crimes. The issue is between this demonic system and the future. Nothing is changed if Hitler's liquidated and Nazism remains in office. Things could even become worse. It is a question of outcome. The real question is what is responsible toward the future. And then the second point, Hitler's machinery is incredibly complex. I cannot tell you whether you should shoot him. That must be done by men in better positions to calculate the results. That is to say, tell him whether he should shoot him. This should be left to men in better positions to calculate the results. Nothing must be left to chance. All must be coordinated. If you do decide you can and should shoot, then we must all move together. But after the yet unforeseen complications have been discovered and measures have been taken to solve the tactical problems of the revolt. And then the last, von Haeften, I'm going to come back and comment on this. Bonhoeffer and von Haeften never did come to a decision about the should question, even though Bonhoeffer said the may question was answered in confession and absolution by God. That is to say, may he do it. Von Haeften was executed July 20, 1944 because of his part in the failed assassination attempt by Stauffenberg. That morning, he took communion at the church where Martin Niemöller had confirmed him, knowing his friend and colleague Stauffenberg was on his way with the bomb. Now, my comment is something that Rasmussen talks about in his book, Reality and Resistance. He thinks that one of the problems of the conspiracy was too much planning. They spent a great deal of time planning, trying to get all the bases covered, because certainly the danger was great that there was going to be a bloodbath afterwards, that this would spread. Rasmussen's point is they kept planning and planning and planning, and they didn't get around to acting. He even makes a comment that maybe it would have been good if they had gotten a gangster into the organization, somebody who had acted, because they didn't act. They planned and planned and planned. Stauffenberg certainly took the bomb. This general that I was talking about, Henning, the one I was quoting before, he was responsible for putting a bomb on Hitler's plane. There was a special bomb with a special fuse, and it did not go off. And they think the reason it didn't go off was the plane reached such an altitude that the fuse froze. So it didn't happen. So there were attempts, like I said, at least 42 known attempts to kill Hitler. But again, Rasmussen's objection that it just went on in the planning stage. And certainly there was a huge problem to solve with the planning. They had the whole upper echelon of the party to deal with, the government. They had the problem of the SS. It was just, you think about it, you can imagine the enormity of the problem. So again, the conspirators constantly planning and not acting, except again, Stauffenberg, and then Stauffenberg's bomb fails. Well, let me stop there and ask comments or questions at this point. The situation is tragic. I think we can say that justly.
Anyone online with a comment?
How was it discovered?
Pardon?
How was the conspiracy discovered?
It's not, well, when Stauffenberg, when the bomb did not go off, they almost got Hitler. Hitler required immediately intense activity on the part of the SS and the Gestapo. And that's when they discovered papers and so forth that exposed the people in the conspiracy.
Yeah, I have heard people say that Bonhoeffer should be viewed as being unselfish in this act because he was kind of giving up his own soul in a way. It wasn't a matter of whether he would be bodily killed, but whether he would be, however we view eternity, that he would be condemned in that way. And he decided, I guess, what this line of thought is, that it was more important to give up that for the benefit of all the rest of the country and the world, as it turned out. I don't know if you've heard that kind of thought, but
yes, one hears a lot of different things, even some anti-Bonhoeffer. An interesting comment I saw was Bonhoeffer was the good conscience of the church after the war, because they could point to him and say, this is what we did. And it wasn't a we. There was no we. It was just Bonhoeffer. I'm going to be talking about the Confessing Church next Sunday when we come to letters and papers and to his criticism of the Confessing Church. I think this is a very important area. And I think your comment touches on that. Did you want to elaborate any further? Or? Next.
If this conspiracy was discovered in July of 44, why did it take him a year to actually execute Bonhoeffer in 45?
Yeah. That's a good question. I don't know that I have the answer to that. He got moved out of Berlin to a concentration camp. And from the concentration camp, he went to Flossenbürg. Of course, some time was taken exposing the conspiracy. So I think he was recognized as a member of the conspiracy not until fall, autumn of 44. We have one last group of texts. And I don't necessarily want to comment on these, I just want to show them to you. Stations on the Way to Freedom, July 21, 1945. Now this is the day after the attempt, and he knows it's failed. He knows it's collapsed, right? Stations on the Way to Freedom, self-discipline. If you set out to seek freedom, you must learn before all things mastery over sense and soul. Action. Do and dare what is right. Bravely take hold of the real. Only in action is freedom. Come out into the tempest of living. God's command is enough, and your faith in him to sustain you. Then at last, freedom will welcome your spirit amid great rejoicing. And the next one, suffering. These hands, so active and powerful, are now tied. Alone and fainting, you see where your work ends. And yet you are confident still and gladly commit what is right into a stronger hand. You yielded your freedom into the hand of God, that he might perfect it in glory. And death, the last one. Come now, highest of feasts, on the journey to freedom eternal, death, strike off the fetters, break down the walls that oppress us. Our blinded souls, our temporal body, that we may see at last that which here remains hidden. Freedom, long did we seek you in discipline, action, suffering. And now as we die, we see you and know you at last, face to face. A remarkable statement. Well, thank you. You've been very attentive, very quiet. I hope that means you followed pretty well. I hope to see you next week. Thank you. Ahem.